Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today we're live. Please ignore that promo.
We're moving past that
we're
one.
Moving past that one. Mm-hmm. I knew my day was not going to be perfect. And there we go. Because today we're talking about the Holy Grail.
Exactly. And
apropos on a Sunday, right?
Mm-hmm. It's fun.
The Holy Grail for you as a cook is what we want to hear about.
Okay.
So, I mean, I know you and I both had those experiences.
Definitely.
And it's not just that thing, that dish that you're questing to be able to prepare, right? It's that dish that you cannot imagine you'll ever be able to prepare. So there are really kind of two levels to it. So when we hear from you this morning, we want to know not just, we want you not just to brag, hey, this was tough and I got this done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I tried 14 times and I pulled it off.
That's awesome. I like that.
Or I'm brilliant and I did it the first time.
That's always good.
Which is good. But we'd also want to hear, but there's this one thing, I can't imagine ever getting that. Mm-hmm. But I want to.
Yep.
And we may
I'm really curious.
Give you advice and we may just tell you to stop. But you can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. We're happy to read some of the emails on the air.
Mm-hmm.
All the ones that are nice and not naughty. And we get spectacular emails from listeners.
So. Yeah, we do. It's always fun. We love hearing from you. So what do you think your Holy Grail was when you first started cooking
or first started
working in the business?
I wanted to be able to roast things. You know, I worked with a bunch of old Europeans in a kitchen, and this one Danish chef, Lee, who ran the Governor's Club kitchen, he would come in. He was just came with a briefcase that had his knives and things.
Oh, that's so cool. I love that.
His whites were perfect. And
did he wear a neckerchief?
He did wear...
Old school chefs wore neckerchiefs. Actually, we had to wear those when we were in culinary school. I don't know if they still do that or not.
He did. He essentially did not speak. He was a very mild man.
Wow, that's good. That's nice.
And, well, no one else was really allowed to speak.
That's not old school, to be nice. Yeah.
I didn't say he was nice. I said he didn't speak. And he was very good at roasting things, not just, you know, that... There were other people in that kitchen who were good at grilling things and at salads and, you know, seafood dishes, all that sort of stuff. But Lee's the kind of guy you get a half a lamb in or a lamb in and break down the shoulder, give it a lot of care, and he would lard the lamb shoulder with more of the fat from the belly. And
mm-hmm. Good.
And
wonderful.
You know, pop it with cloves and crushed bay leaves and coriander seeds and garlic and roast it, cool it, you know. And you like if you got really lucky, you were somewhere around when he had that going, and you'd peel a little bit of the crust off the outside of that guy, and have it with a piece of bread. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So for me, it was the figuring out how to that patient fire to roast something, whether it's a lamb shoulder or I know you had a veal shoulder that I cooked one time. Actually, it was braised, but
mm-hmm.
that kind of slow, patient cooking that develops a lot of flavor and it takes half of your damn day.
And it ends up being so tender when you braise. Well, when you're braising
and
something,
and it's not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's you know that it's really fun to make pretty plates, but it's not pretty. It's literally I was talking about like the, you know, peeling something crusty off of
a
piece of roasted lamb and a piece of bread.
Mm-hmm.
As being some kind of a peak, but it was just the most flavor that I'd had.
I'm sure. Well, and also I think when it comes down to it, I mean, when you roast something like a chicken, you think it's so every day, but you and I both know it's the sign of a very, very good cook when you can really beautifully roast a chicken. That is the sign of a good kitchen, a good chef, a good cook. And it's not the easiest thing to do. You know, it's like all things with cooking. You just have to practice, no matter what it is. And I think that's the whole philosophy. You have to be brave, and you have to practice.
Well, we tell people that in one restaurant, if you want that now, the roasted chicken.
Right.
Wait an hour.
Yeah, it's going to be a while. But
that's just the way it goes.
But I think that's the answer to sort of the Holy Grail, too, is that if there is something that you want to make, you just have to research it or ask a chef or ask someone and try and get as much information as you can. But just try it. There's no reason not to try it, unless it's unbelievably expensive. That's where, you know, I would probably draw the line if I wasn't a professional cook. But, you know,
I've not seen you draw the line a whole lot on that.
But I am a professional cook, so that's the difference. I don't need to draw any lines.
I see those invoices.
Yeah, but you know when you were talking about cooking, when you worked at the Governor's Club, I remember you always talked about being a bartender. So you were in the kitchen there as well?
I was in the dish room there. I was on the line there. I did cooking stations out in the dining room. I set up banquets.
So you did everything. You worked in all the areas.
I did everything.
That's so cool.
The reason why I like everything
when you were so
now
young, when you
is
started
because
there.
It's what I've always done.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've always done everything.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, and me too. I mean,
I arranged the flowers.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I was never a dishwasher, but I skipped that. I went right to prep on the garbage day station.
You're a cleaning maniac. You're fine.
I love that, and I also waited tables in the beginning too. So
let's get a hold of Frank here in Baltimore. Frank, why don't you go ahead?
Hi, Frank.
Good morning. How are you both?
Good. How are you, Frank?
I'm good.
Are you all sprung forward?
I'm all sprung forward, and guess who else is all sprung forward? The Shad.
Yay.
It's about time for the Shad run.
Yeah,
I saw my first Shad Instagram yesterday.
I did too, yeah.
Yeah. Well, my dad, he used to get into the zone. Let me say, growing up in West Baltimore, you knew it was springtime when you heard the A-Rabber shout out from his wagon, Roshad, Roshad, and coming into the neighborhood bringing it to you. Well, my dad would get the Shad, clean it, open it up, and then he would stuff it with a turkey-style, you know, bread stuff, breadcrumbs, you know, with the veggies, you eat a little onion and this, that, and the other. And then he would put that inside the Shad, double wrap it in aluminum foil, and put it in an oven that was maybe 250, 260, and just cook it there for like 6 hours.
Oh, wow.
And then the bones would melt away to nothing, you know, as they do. And then he would take it out and let it cool and then put it in the refrigerator. And then the next day, you could just go with the shad still wrapped and cut it, into portions and either reheat it and eat it or eat it cold.
Mm. Did you serve it with a sauce when you had it cold?
Yeah. And it was... he got into the zone, and he had seven sisters, and he passed away 6 years ago. But at the end of this run, he would make one every day and then take it to one of his sisters, and then he'd get another one and put it in.
Oh, that's so nice.
And for like the entire month of March, every day he was cooking a shed. I'd better give one to such and such. And he'd go back and get another.
Was your dad a fisherman?
No, he was a bus driver.
Okay.
But let me say... pertinent to this show, he drove that bus. He was one of the first black bus drivers in Baltimore. And that bus allowed him to go in through all of the ethnic neighborhoods. And his riders, he developed fans. And they would bring him stuff, grape leaves, moussaka, lasagna, with little tips on how to cook this, you know, yourself. And he would bring it home to us.
Oh.
And going back, you were talking last week about the ethnic influences on cuisine here in America. Here in Baltimore, a lot of German influence, hence the Baltimore style of having sauerkraut at Thanksgiving.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And he would make his sauerkraut with corned pigtails. In the sauerkraut rather than any other sort of pork. And it was just to die for. And so,
that sounds
got
great.
A lot of good memories about that.
Sounds good, Frank.
Good for you, Frank.
Yeah, thanks for reminding us. It's Shad time.
Yes.
And the Shad Row, you can talk about that.
Hmm.
Once again, that's a little too high above my, knowing exactly what to do with it. But he knew what to do with Shad Row as well.
Oh, you were lucky to have him for a father. That's very special.
Yes, I was.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks, Frank.
Okay.
Have a good Sunday.
Mm. You too.
Wow.
So... yeah, Shad Row for a lot of people is a huge you know.
My mom always talked about it this time of the year. You know, my mom loved shad, and that's, again, you know, my parents are from York, and that was a big part of their springtime. You know, I know my grandmother was a very good cook, and both of my grandmothers were, and I know that was very special to them.
The trick with shad roe is getting it not to explode in your face.
Right.
When you're cooking it in the pan.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that using a shield or something is mm-hmm. is important, or you're going to pay for it.
Right.
So, how about you?
Holy
I didn't
girl.
Give you a dish, but I gave you a technique and a process.
Mm-hmm.
So, what dish, let's say, when you're first looking at your Georges Blanc book and it's the mid-80s or something like mm-hmm. that, what's the thing that like, oh my gosh, I'm going to make that?
Well, I had never eaten frog's legs. Excuse me. And Georges Blanc's cookbook was just full of, it was very seasonal, completely seasonal. And the photographs were just so brilliantly beautiful. And it just, there was so, the plating styles were so unusual, like nothing I had ever seen at that time.
Well, they're playful. It was really some of the first really playful plates.
Mm-hmm. And he did a watercress sauce for frog's legs. And I was just totally fascinated with that. First of all, I couldn't imagine what frog's legs tasted like. I don't remember ever seeing them on a menu anywhere. I'd been in the United States. And I just couldn't wait to have that. And also he does the traditional preparation with garlic and butter. And of course, you and I went there and I had that dish. And it was something that I had looked forward to ever since I was 19 years old when I got that cookbook. And so I would definitely say that was something that I always, and really it was his style that was my sort of holy grail. lots of dots on the plates. I've always liked dots. And, you know, that's always been my thing. You know, I even have china now that's a series of, you know, indentations yeah. that are dots on it. And, yeah, so I think that for me, some of these things that I'd never eaten were sort of my holy grail. And frog's legs were certainly one of those things.
Do you recall the first time you prepared them?
Yes. Yes. And we did, you know, lightly dust them with flour. First of all, I learned that you had to buy them fresh, and of course, and that you wanted to get them from either the United States or from France.
I recall getting some in Savannah that you had shipped that were
terrible.
Just
yeah,
awful.
And I think they came from, you know, well, they came from far away. So I learned that right away that was not okay. I didn't know. I mean, and I think that, you know, I obviously didn't know they were frozen, quite frankly, at that time. Yeah, I learned about a lot of cooking at Savannah. That's for sure. I had never worked with foie gras before I started cooking foie gras at Savannah. And lightly dusted them with flour and definitely did, you know, the sort of butter, garlic, shallot, fresh parsley, and served them very, very simply. But, you know, they can be quite incredible. You do lightly dust them with the flour, shake them off, a little salt in the flour, and you want a hot pan. And I would suggest clarified butter because it doesn't take that long to cook them. And so they are, that you know, we pretty quickly learned about that.
Well, we're talking today, we're live, we're talking about your personal holy grail of cooking, and you can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org, and we're going to go out with a little bit of theme music from Monty Python's The Holy Grail, because besides great dishes, sometimes you need great comedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today and we're talking about the Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, your personal Holy Grail of cooking. That thing, or you can call us and brag about what it is that you've achieved. Mm-hmm. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. Or maybe there is that distant... you know, that holy grail of the future for you, that thing that you have not yet been able to achieve but are determined to...
Or the thing you tried and couldn't do. Mm-hmm.
And call us, maybe we'll tell you the thing is something you shouldn't do. You never know. We have
never know.
We do have a couple of emails, though. This is from Sarah in Baltimore. The one meal I would love to make is palak paneer with bonus samosas. Bonus samosas is a nice term. And I've never been able to get it just right. Maybe it's a mental block or some secret I don't know, but I keep failing. Help.
Huh. I don't know how to make that. I can't help with that one. Hmm.
Yeah, it's definitely outside of either one of our wheelhouses. I definitely find Indian food inspiring.
I love Indian food.
And just like anything else, the quality of ingredients is a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
And finding all the ingredients is much easier now than it used to be, so that's got to be helpful.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, starting with, confirm your sourcing on everything, you want a good source book to work from.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't work,
try again.
Wish you could help more.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got a caller on, Valerie in Bel Air. Valerie, go ahead.
Hi, Valerie.
Hello. Good to talk to you guys. I just turned your program on, and I heard you talking about frog legs and the importance of getting them really fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a story about frog legs. I was in Singapore once at the Poor Man's Nightclub, they call it, and it's a area in Singapore at night, overnight, they have all these food trucks, kiosks, where you get fresh food and you hang out.
Huh.
So I walked up to this one kiosk, and there was a guy there with a big wok, and he had frog legs written across the top. So I thought, well, this is the place to try frog legs. So I said, I'll take some frog legs, paid the man. He reached into a barrel, pulled out a frog.
Oh, my
live
God.
Chop the legs off and put them in the wok.
Well, that's really fresh.
And I walked away. I almost passed out. I walked away, and I was like, okay, I can't do this. And then I felt bad because
Valerie, it's just like a lobster tank for frogs, right?
I know, but you piss the lobster. I've gotten fresh lobster before, and I piss them before I put them in the pot. And then there was a story about foie gras, because I lived in the Netherlands for a while, and foie gras, you know, is the Belgians are really proud of their foie gras.
Mm-hmm.
But when I heard the story about how they feed the goose and all that, I decided I was never going to eat foie gras for animal rights issues. So I was in another country, and someone was hosting a party and had the whole menu planned out. And I was sitting there. I was the only American in this group of Europeans. And the first course was foie gras. And I didn't want to be, I didn't want to be discourteous to my host. So I thought, okay, I'm going to eat it because my host is serving me this. I took one bite of it, Cindy, and I was like, oh, my God, this is the best thing
exactly.
I've ever tasted
exactly.
in my life.
It is amazing. Mm-hmm.
It is
good
amazing.
For you.
Ah. I think you can also, that sometimes the way that foie gras methodology is presented is a little less complicated and a little less natural than what often our practice is in a lot of places where foie gras is raised.
It's skewed sometimes.
So I would...
Yeah, so you can feel...
If you do more complete and balanced research, you may find a little bit more reassuring information. That can help your guilt feelings about how much you love
mm-hmm.
that foie gras.
Yeah, our farm in the United States I've visited, and it's their practices are very fair and good. So, but good for you that you tried it, and... So you didn't go back and get the frog's legs? You just couldn't do it?
I couldn't.
Yeah. All right.
I couldn't.
I would eat like 40 of them.
I was going to say, actually, I would have been a little freaked out for a second, but then I would have been like, ooh, okay, well, if I'm going to eat frog's legs here, I'd rather they were this fresh. So, you know, when you're traveling, you want the things to be fresh like that. All right. Well, that's a good story, Valerie. Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
Thanks for
Thank
calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's I have no complaint for you know, I mean, you want things as fresh as
well,
you
it's
can
just
get
you
them.
Don't expect somebody to pull them out of the barrel and like do it right there. But you know, as you pointed out, it's just because we're not used to it. That's what it comes down to. We're not used to it.
And
as you pointed
always,
out, a lobster is something we're all pretty well used to. So yes, what were you gonna say?
The nicest quail that you can get, you know, come fresh with the head on and the feet on.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And you roast them whole. And if you leave those things intact, people are they will get upset about it.
Yeah. So did you have shad roe growing up? So how did you guys cook it? Because I don't recall ever having it. I mean, I know my mom used to talk about it, but I think because I lived in, you know, the South when I was little and Northern Indiana when I was older. I don't believe it was available to us.
It's probably
I think
the
my
kind of thing your parents
might have
driven
it.
Down to Baltimore to get or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
I would love to hear people's favorite preparations for shad roe if they have a favorite. My great-grandmother was not from here, but she liked it. She liked the fish in particular. And she would for both of those things, the fish she would cornmeal fry in a skillet.
Okay.
You know, and just serve with like chow chow, basically, you know, pickled vegetables and that sort of business. And mayonnaise with a whole bunch of fresh chives in it, which was pretty darn good.
Yeah, that sounds good.
For the shad roe, she'd sear it in the pan and deglaze the pan with a little scuppernong wine, which is a sweet wine from North Carolina.
That's fun.
And
interesting.
And just serve that with a little bit of vinegar on the side, and you know, it, sweet and sour shad roe is basically what you served.
Okay.
And I don't know at all if that is traditional, because that's the one way that I've eaten it.
Yeah, I mean, I know we made it in culinary school, and I just recall that we served it with brown butter. I feel like that's what we did. Yeah, I wonder if that's probably the most traditional way. But
pretty typical.
Yeah, that's.
But yeah, love to hear from especially experienced cooks from the region. If you know, maybe that was your holy grail.
Yeah, maybe.
So I've got one of the quick email comment question. I make excellent tiramisu, so much easier than I thought, Jim in Parkville.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's fun to make, too. I love all the layers, and and it's so satisfying. And, yeah, it's so similar to a trifle as well. I mean, it's sort of such an old-style dessert that's...
Well, it's basically a bowl of soaked...
Of goodness.
Goodness, you know.
Yeah, tiramisu is, golly, yeah. I remember the first time I made tiramisu. It was pretty exciting, I have to say. Made it with mascarpone and...
Well, really, the outcome is not what you expect when you start to organize ingredients.
Well, yeah, and the cookies aren't so great on their own. They really do need to be dipped in something, yeah. Well, they're the perfect vehicle for it.
There are a lot of soaked desserts, especially in Italian pastry. And now exactly what you soak them with, that's really kind of the fun that you can have with that.
Yeah, I used to soak mine with amaretto and a little bit of espresso.
Yeah, I had tiramisu in the Veneto that they soaked with a kind of grappa made from cherries and cherry pits called Ciliegie and espresso and a hazelnut liqueur or amaro of some sort. It was definitely a bit bitter and was very interesting. That bittersweet quality in that dessert was very interesting.
You know, I think I still have a holy grail. It's and I've made it and my version of it. But it is, you know what it is. You know what it's going to be.
So what is it? Brag.
It's the macaroni with the truffle and the foie gras from La Serre. That dish is one of the best dishes I've ever had in my life. It's funny, I recently saw someone did a version of it, and that was on Instagram, and it was a very different version of it. But the whole idea of a long macaroni stuffed with foie gras and truffle, and then it has a sauce
long like the length of a pen, right?
I mean. Yeah, exactly. And just the idea of, well, how do you do that to start with? You know, imagine making that for, you know, 50 or 150 people in service. I can imagine doing it for one person or a
group. So how do you do it? How do you get it in there?
You pipe it in. You know, you use a little pastry bag and pipe it in. And then it has a, what I always loved about it was it's sort of such the height of luxury to me is slicing a truffle and cutting it out into perfect little circles. Here we go. Come back to circles. And, you know, there you have the trimmings, which of course then becomes sauce or can be used in a rice or something. But it can be used in a million different ways, quite frankly. But having the perfect little circles of the truffle on the plate and the like Reggiano cream and a little bit of reduction sauce with the chopped truffle in it and just the decadence of the dish is just, oh my gosh. And the macaroni, those long tubes of macaroni are cut into a perfect circle. And that sort of dumbfounded me the first time I saw it too. I'm like, wait, how do you do that? And, you know, I just chilled mine. It's actually not hard to do. Once you stuff them, you lay them out. I think for me, because I was always trained from the very beginning that there should be no waste in food product, that I couldn't imagine how you would do that and not waste a lot of product. Well, there is no way. You have to just waste some product when you make it. But you literally just, you know, lay out the tubes of the pasta one against the other and use a cutter and cut it out and put it on something that you can transfer it. And then the next question is, how do you heat it? How do you heat a piece of pasta that's stuffed? I mean, it's already cooked, obviously. But it needs to become hot. So how do you do that? So I just did that on a sizzle pan with a little bit of broth underneath it and foil, really.
So steam it, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
The figuring out of things like that is, it's the two or three steps that you had to redo to try to figure it out.
Yeah,
those
that was
the
not
things
the easiest.
That make you remember.
Yeah, that was not the easiest one. And that chef who came up with that dish, he has his own restaurant now. And I accidentally went to his restaurant one time when I was in Paris. I didn't even realize it was him. I had been told it was an excellent place, so I walked down from my hotel. And I sat down, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is that chef. And, of course, it was on the menu. And just absolutely a brilliant dish.
It's nice to have a dish that's become, you know, really emblematic and, you know, iconic, and to have it from the creator.
Definitely. Been eating it for probably 18 years.
I have a quick off-topic email from a listener. This is from Kathy. Hi, not sure if this is the right show to ask this question. My fiance and I are honeymooning in Italy in May. Any chance you could help narrow down some favorites from the Tuscan region? I'm sure the list could be extraordinarily long. I mean, in Tuscany, I think that they're interesting wineries to visit in a lot of places, that's for certain. It's maybe not always the most involved cuisine, but pretty darn satisfying. There's a butcher who's become very famous in Panzano, Dario Cicchini, who is bananas and has a couple of restaurants in Panzano. A nice place to visit Panzano and go to one of his places, be prepared to eat a lot of meat. And to visit Fontori, which is really one of the best Chianti Classico producers, that's a very nice day.
Yes,
I would say that. But there's a whole that whole ridge between the mountain ridge between Florence and Siena, the Val di Chiana, the real heart of the Chianti Classico zone, which is all at a little bit of altitude. There are lots of beautiful little towns and interesting places to visit, and not a tremendous amount of pretentious food, but a pretty good amount of very satisfying stuff. Mm. And you expect things driven by meat, by beans, by vegetables, strong vegetables, kale, artichokes, this sort of thing. And Florence has all of its own attractions, of course. Siena is one of those cities that's, to me, like a perfect scale.
Siena is so beautiful.
Very, very walkable.
Oh, what a lovely, lovely place. So, I'd like to go back there someday.
Let's take a call from Jimmy in Owings Mills. Jimmy, go ahead.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. How
really
are you?
Good. I just wanted to say I've enjoyed your food and establishments and some wonderful memories on some great party nights. I lost Mom a little while ago, and one of my favorite memories was, Cindy, you had done a trio of creme brulees, and she had broken into the first and started to giggle like a 16-year-old girl and made everyone just be quiet.
Oh my gosh.
Think it might have been a tea-flavored creme brulee. I don't remember. But
we've done some green tea ones over the years.
Mm-hmm. Amazing stuff.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
I've been lucky enough to sort of master some of my Neapolitan and Abruzzese grandmother's things, you know, pasta and all of the doughs and the different Easter pies and even a fairly decent osso buco. When I actually take the time and remember to put some of her love in it. My question is, though, with my favorite chocolate cake ever, and I've attempted it three times, and each time I've been able to eat it out of a bowl anyway, and it's been sort of tasty, but it's never held up as a cake, and it's Gaston Lenotre's Concord cake, and it's basically three rings of chocolate meringue with chocolate mousse in between the layers and a ganache on top. And I've just never gotten the hang to bake those meringue rings in a way where after they're refrigerated a while, they become soft. So what I get is sort of, you know, tasty meringue crumbles in a, that I could eat with all of the mousse that surrounds it. And I've just never been able to get it to stand up. So if you have any hints on the art of meringue, I'd appreciate it.
How are you approaching the meringue? How are you making it? Do you remember?
I keep the eggs cold. I keep the bowl cold. I do it in my KitchenAid and add the sweetener and the cocoa as directed, and then attempt a piping. Which I usually have to clean up a little bit, but I draw the ovals and I try to make them, and I bake them very low and then shut the oven off and let them ride a little bit.
Good. Okay.
And sort of that's it.
Is it coming out too? Are you saying because it crumbles, it sounds like it's coming out too dry? That's what's happening.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
Always remember the person, the CIA graduate who I first had it from, you know, said, oh, the refrigeration will soften the meringue.
Well, one of the things about meringue is it depends on the humidity in the air and the time of year that you're making it. It's very different to make meringue in the wintertime than it is to make it in the summertime. So with the humidity in the summer, it makes it much softer. With the dry air in the winter, it's much drier. So if you, by chance, are over-whipping your whites or over-baking it, that could be drying it out too much. And especially if you're making it in the wintertime, then that's a double whammy, basically, and that it's just going to be too dry. So the recipe suggests that you put it in the refrigerator, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. All right. You almost have to because of the mousse anyway. And the mousse is holding up?
Yes.
Okay, so the mousse is not the problem. It's the meringue. Maybe you're over-baking it. Maybe that's what it comes down to, is you're just drying it.
Maybe, as an amateur, I'm always afraid to pull out and think about the continuing cooking.
Okay.
I'll just be a little brave.
Here's a suggestion. Pipe out a little extra meringue on the corner of the sheet and maybe a couple little spots of it, and that way you can test it before you draw it out. Okay?
Oh, that's easy.
Yeah.
Great.
Yes.
Thanks a lot.
You bet. Thanks, Jimmy.
Take care, guys.
You
Bye.
Too.
Thank you. I'm willing to bet you're right about the both maybe a little bit of the over-whipping and the...
Meringue is not the easiest thing in the world to make. It really isn't. And there's so many different types of meringue. And it's really something somebody should show you how to do.
What if you just make that, the Italian meringue that's a little bit softer anyway?
Mm-hmm. Lenotre's recipes are very, very obviously great. So he's one of the greatest pastry chefs that's ever lived.
So you can reach us today. We're live, 410-662-8780. The topic of the moment is the Holy Grail. What is your Holy Grail dish that you've achieved, or what is a Holy Grail dish that you would like to achieve, like Jimmy's Lenotre chocolate cake? Mm-hmm. And you can also email us, foremanwolf@wipr.org, or reach us, 410-662-8780. And are you ready for a chef's challenge?
I think
we might have to sneak one in there.
I think you may not be, Tony. I'm not sure, though.
No.
We'll see.
I'm pretty sleepy.
You're not going to like this one, Tony.
I'm just... Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're live today. We're talking about the Holy Grail, not the Monty Python movie, as much as I love it. We're talking about that dish that you either have achieved, but really maybe the dish that you have not yet achieved that you want to get done. And you were smart to ask me earlier, what was that thing like back in those days that I wanted to do? Mm-hmm. So what is the thing now that you have not yet done or have thought of doing? What dish is that you want to get done, want to be able to master? Hmm. And this could be at home. This could be at work.
Right now I'm working on galantines and ballantines, and it's something I've done on and off over the last maybe 10 years or so. And I, you know, my grandfather had a butcher shop, and my dad grew up, you know, like, working in it from the time he was a little boy. So, I mean, it's definitely
it's
in my blood.
All in the quality of farce, baby.
Exactly. and I just made the last one I made. And also, for me, it's the whole classic French cooking thing. For me, it's making
it's
some
because
of these incredible traditional dishes. What's
you
that?
Sound like an American woman, but you actually are a 170-year-old French man.
Yeah. French chef. One lives inside of me, as Mr. Parker said one time. Yeah, that's a compliment. I really, really, really do love the work that used to go into classic French cooking, you know, with the aspics and the all sorts of, you know, beautiful artwork that basically went into making food, but the food didn't taste that good. So my goal is to make that food, but make it taste as, you know, as great as all the rest of the food that, you know, we tried to make.
And a lot of times those things were for hiding instead of for amplifying flavors.
Sure. And you're talking about cooking that's over 100 years old, so there wasn't a lot of refrigeration. You know, there was no refrigeration. You know, as how did they cool their product and or keep it healthy and safe? And, you know, that's why they often masked things with spices and things, because the food didn't taste very good, as you said. But
or super heavy sauces.
Yeah, super heavy sauces, exactly. And that's, you know, with the advent of nouvelle cuisine of French cooking in the 50s and into the 60s, that was, you know, refrigeration was everywhere by that time. It was after World War II, and people were, you know, the French chefs were taking a new approach towards their food. They didn't, you know, because frozen food and canned food had been around for a while, so they really did not want that. They wanted to have fresh food, and they were, you know, getting things from their local farmers instead of, you know, these convenience sort of items that had become popular. So
Italian in their approach.
Nouvelle cooking was very much about freshening and lightening things up, and not those heavy sauces and heavy spices and covered with everything and all that. So there's a way to do that and have it be a good thing. And so that's sort of my focus right now as a chef is to, you know, my holy grail is definitely, what's it called? It's that fish forcemeat with pike. What's it called? I can't think of it right now. Golly. Well, I'll think of it in a minute, but, it's quenelle. Quenelle de brochette. And, it is, oh gosh, it is
getting those guys light
enough.
Yes,
that's the whole thing.
Yeah, the eggs have got to be crazy fresh to get that kind of
it's got to be the just exact right ratio of egg whites to cream to force meat, and it's a fish force meat typically made from pike, and you know, this is a tender white fish, and you have to, you know, this is a lot of steps. Well, now we have food processors, so you can put it into the food processor, but you have to have the right amount of whites, the right amount of cold. Everything has to be super cold. The cream has to be perfect. The cream has to be really good
if you're going to make with American sauce, which is the classic way.
That part I have down. The American sauce, I have no problem with.
It's one of those, like, it can't be too spicy. When I've had that where it's not exactly right, it's the sauce is a little, because that can tend a little spicy.
Right. No, I don't have that. That I'm proud of. I can make that well, but it's just getting the right texture on those. And I remember a long time ago, Lee, who used to work for me at you know, more than one of our restaurants had the joy of working for Jean-Louis Paladin, who is one of the greatest three-star Michelin chefs that was ever in the United States. And he came over from France, obviously. And she worked for him, and he taught her how to make quenelles. And we made the, that was the first time I think I ever made them in the kitchen. She and I did it together. We did little ones with spoons. And oh my goodness, they were just perfect. And he actually didn't put egg whites in his. He only put cream in. And that was startling to me to see her make it that way. And Lee Weinfeld, where are you? Are you listening, Lee?
Maybe. Let me get an email here. And you can still potentially sneak in a call, 410-662-8780. Or email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. And this is from Gene. For my husband, his holy grail is the elusive, perfect, thin pizza crust. A novice home cook, he's been working it for years, and he's gotten it nearly perfect now. I always think
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's so much is about surface
and the flour.
But I mean, making the dough the right way and getting enough oil in that dough, but the right temperature and the right surface.
Good for him.
For me, also a home cook with more experience, I find it's hard to make eggs the way I like them. Sometimes it's the little things.
Oh.
Eggs are pretty contemplative to cook, especially cook correctly.
That's another sign of a very good cook, is being able to make a perfect scrambled egg to me.
The egg book that you love so much.
Michel Roux.
R-O-U-X.
One of the best.
That's, oh my gosh. That's a good reference.
His little books, he has one on eggs, one on pastry, one on sauces. Oh, those are such great resources and great photographs. It's a little book. And he has some step-by-step photographs in there. I mean, that man knows how to write he's a great chef, one of the greatest chefs, and he knows how to write a cookbook and execute it. Love those books.
I've got one last email here. This is from Brad. I've always wanted to cook ribs and don't know where to start. I think I'm just intimidated. Any advice on how to cook them without a smoker?
You know, I can totally understand that. Ribs are intimidating. I never make ribs. Well, I can't serve them where I cook
I think it's just like roasting anything else. It's care in their seasoning and or marinade.
Well, and yeah, but the thing is that they're tough. So if you're just roasting them, how do you make them tender?
I would braise them. I mean,
yeah,
that's,
you can't roast
them. You're going to want to get good caramelization in the oven.
Or you could braise them and pop them in a hot oven to, you know, crisp them up a tiny bit. But
yeah, frankly, I would braise them, cool them, and then when you want to serve them, cut a couple of ribs, put them on the grill, get them all crispy on the outside. And
you'll
have a lot of flavor. It'll still be a little juicy inside.
Yeah, but you're right. It is a braising process. You're going to have to braise them. So it's sear them, you know, add carrot, celery, onion, a little bit of spices if you want, bay leaf, peppercorn, something, you know, maybe chili powder, maybe cumin, cayenne, you know, whatever flavor you're looking for, braise them until they're tender. And then you have to decide if that's the end of it for you or cook them up a little bit.
Let's take one last caller here, Marshall. Marshall, go ahead.
Hi, Marshall.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It sounds like you have things you need to talk about.
Well, I do 99% of the cooking in the home for me and my wife, and she loves eggs, poached eggs, scrambled eggs, fried eggs, but I can't stand them, and I know that sounds weird.
What did eggs do to you?
The only way I can describe it is that they're too eggy.
Oh,
you know.
Okay, buddy.
So I've tried, but I'm constantly faced with the challenge on the weekends of trying to prepare eggs that I in no way want to taste. So I have no idea if they're going to be good or not. Mm. And sometimes I think she's just humoring me and saying, like, yeah, these taste good.
You know, out of learn how to make really good scrambled eggs.
Yes.
Make them a little firmer than Cindy would teach you to do. Not a lot, but a little firmer, but nice and fluffy. And start making yourself with all kinds of things that you love to eat, like burritos with scrambled eggs in there, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And you can start to, you can please her and start to convert yourself. And if you know, that, right? So maybe you make a little bit of, you know, like black bean chili or something like that.
Okay.
That, fresh cilantro. A little bit of queso fresco, you know, a little green onion, and toss the scrambled eggs in there, well seasoned. and roll that sucker up and get yourself a beer and have a little brunch.
And also get some really good eggs. And if you handle them delicately, you'll find. I mean, my sister hates scrambled eggs, but she'll eat mine. And that's because I make them with great care. And one of the things about scrambling an egg is you need to break up the curd of the egg. So it's low heat, low and slow, low heat. Use a fork or a whisk and break that egg up, but keep it moving in the pan, shake the pan, and butter. Don't use something weird in there. Just use butter, fresh butter. Don't use old butter. Don't use frozen butter.
Or butter that smells like the fridge.
Yeah, gross butter. Just good butter, good egg. Ooh, that's the other thing. Eggs are porous, so they absorb all the odors in your refrigerator. And that's one of the reasons why you really want to keep them in that compartment that they have for eggs in there, because you don't want them to absorb the flavor or smell of the peppers and the garlic and the onions that you have in your fridge. So if you handle the eggs a little more delicately maybe than what you are, and you may end up liking them. If you can't taste them, if you won't taste them, you're not going to be able to make anything excellent unless you have awfully good skills with salting and peppering something, okay?
Well, I really appreciate the help. So maybe I just need to trick myself into liking eggs.
Well, if you come up with one dish where you can enjoy them, then you'll move forward.
Yeah.
I'll give my one other pet breakfast thing with a tortilla, because you can go to like Sinaloa and Fells Point and get really good fresh tortillas to work with. If you scramble an egg, whether you use a little bit of chorizo, fresh onion, a little fresh tomato, get it all a little bit warm in a pan, toss that in with the eggs onto the tortilla, fold the tortilla on itself, put it in a griddle or like a cast iron pan, get it a little bit crispy in oil on each side. I've neglected to say, put a little bit of cheese in there that you like, whether it's cheddar or queso fresco or even mozzarella, something that's going to melt.
Mm-hmm.
Give yourself that.
Pretty soon you're not going to be able to taste the eggs at all.
give yourself that. And the eggs will be involved with these things that you're happy about. And then you'll start to...
All right. I want to report back, Marshall.
All right. I will. I appreciate the advice.
All right, sir.
This could be the beginning of a journey for me.
All right, sir. All the best.
Thank you.
All right. Go forth and conquer. Oh my gosh, I love eggs, and they are one of the most the least expensive things you can work with. They are so versatile.
People don't respect cooking them.
Well,
a lot of
the
times.
Other thing, you know, talk about a holy grail. Holy grail is souffle for some people, and it's a lot easier than you would think to make.
Well, we'll have to get to that sort of stuff on another program, because this one
is over.
Yeah, exactly right. So, if you want to download this program or any of the others, please go to the WYPR webpage, wypr.org. Look up the Foreman Wolf page, and there's a full menu of goodies on there for you. If you want to email us, reach us, foremanwolf@wypr.org, with comments, questions, offline conversation, happy to help with things. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf or on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
And you're a dandy poster.
I love photographs. That's why I like Instagram.
On Instagram, you can get me, the real Tony Foreman. I'm an extremely infrequent poster. Anyway, thanks so much for listening today.
Happy Sunday.